For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
And hello, welcome to Life Matters this morning on RN. Another week ahead. Terrific to have your ears as ever. We know that reading to children right from the go-get can make a difference in terms of building their literacy and their passion for words. In fact, it can help them with their early mathematical awareness too. There's all sorts of creative ways you can use that very hungry little caterpillar to build numerical talent. In fact, Nicola Yalland has a whole kit bag of possibilities for parents and for teachers for turning mathematical concepts and processes into play right from the moment that Bub stands up in her cot, it seems. And she's joining me this morning, as will a man who has lived life to its fullest, still is, Trader Faulkner, actor, raconteur, flamenco dancer. Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier were amongst his friends, and one of his first major roles on the stage was taking over, I gather, from Richard Burton on a Broadway show. Can't wait to meet him today. Don't forget, we're on Twitter, at RN Life Matters. You can talk to us on Facebook, and of course our listener feedback line, 02 833 1430. On Life Matters, we're keeping a watching brief with your help on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS. If you live with a disability or you support someone who does, this is a major reform with a lot of hope riding on its implementation in the coming years. And recently, you might recall, we looked at the sorts of new skills that will be needed to put in place the care plans under the scheme. Well, today we're meeting some of the scheme's first participants to find out what their experience is so far. In July last year, four locations became trial sites, including a place that's been in the news for very different reasons this past week with the announced closure of Alcoa. The Barwon area, in and around the Victorian city of Geelong. And joining us today is Rebecca Casson. She's the CEO of what's called the Committee for Geelong. They're a coalition of various organisations who advocate for the region. She's played a really active role in getting her city to host the trial, and she's been involved in an innovative project designed to assist those first users of the scheme. Welcome, Rebecca.
Good morning, how are you?
Very well, and happy to have with us Vanessa McCallum. She's an anaesthetic nurse. She's the mother of a young disabled daughter called Taylor. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello, how are you?
Good, and Ali Stewart is with us too, I think, and Ali works in a disability accommodation facility as a carer, but she is also the parent of two adult children, Rick and Meg, both with autistic spectrum disorders and both with quite different needs by the sounds. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Natasha.
Rebecca, why were you so dead keen to have Geelong as the host of one of the first rollouts?
Well, firstly, as you've outlined this morning, Natasha, the Committee for Geelong is an independent membership-based organisation, and our members represent the physical spectrum and breadth of industry both by sector and size. We do what other interest groups are often not in a position to do, which is why the Victorian Government chose the committee to implement the Lead Barwon project. Certainly, the Victorian Government has invested $400,000 in this important project, which is providing participants with the key skills that they need to share their experiences of the NDIS, which is so important for Geelong, particularly at this critical time in this structural change.
Yes, indeed. Now, the LEAD project, you mentioned that there. LEAD stands for Learning, Education, Advocacy for Disability. It kicked off, I think, in December. So take us inside that project and what you're doing with the first 20 participants. And I had a look at some of their bios on your website, and tell us how it's all working.
Well, some exceptional participants, and the Victorian Government's investment in this particular program has provided the participants with training in communication, new media, leadership and advocacy skills. So they've recently spoken at a number of conferences and events in their local community and have appeared in countless television and newspaper stories. So we're very, very pleased with their progress, and certainly by sharing their stories, these participants are providing a first-hand account that others can relate to, and obviously to best prepare them for their meetings with planners and exercising the choice, which is so important under the new NDIS scheme.
So these are people that will be beneficiaries of the disability insurance scheme, and this is about empowering them to communicate their needs. Is that at the heart of it?
That's right, and certainly the project is delivering a real insight into how the NDIS is working, and the feedback received is already helping us to prepare the disability sector for future NDIS trials. So it's really important to note that, again, Geelong is at the pointy end of this innovation, and it's really, really exciting.
Well, we'll come back to some of the feedback that you might be getting. I'm interested to know. Vanessa, tell us about your daughter, Taylor, and where things were at before you participated in this trial.
Yes, Taylor, at the moment she's 6 years old. She has a genetic abnormality where a piece of a genetic material was missing as she was developing. So that's manifested her having delays in all areas. She can't walk or talk, although she can sign. She knows about over 100 signs, and she can walk with assistance, but she needs help in every area. Mm. And before she was in NDI, we had limited amount of respite. We would have about 16 hours a month, which we then had to cut and paste over the school holidays to help us there. And she had, with a dual diagnosis of autism, a package which a lot of people may be familiar with, for 2 years. So she had a limit of 2 years of therapy to have a speech therapy and occupational therapy. So that was the extent of the help that we had. And unfortunately, last year, my husband was diagnosed with leukemia. Mm. So we ended up having a wonderful case manager that was for short term to help us get crisis respite to help cope with his needs, with her needs, and basically the function of the family. A family was working and operating on a crisis type of care, with also that very limited window of opportunity, 2 hours of therapy for a little girl, just to try and get her to where she needed to go.
So what has practically changed in terms of your participation in this trial? What have you done that has enabled you as a family to live differently and for Taylor to receive different support as you need it?
Well, a whole looking at Taylor's plan when she went into NDIA, rather than having 16 hours to try and cope with, the planner looked with us, what do we need as a family for Taylor to develop and reach her full potential? Where do we need as a family to go? So she has carers according to her needs. What does she need? So she has carers every morning to help get her ready for school and attend to her personal needs. Looking at on the weekend, she has carers both Saturday and Sunday to help her enter into the community. She now goes down to the local swimming centre with her carer. She goes to the shopping centres. She's having an absolute ball, and as a result, she's thriving. And as a result of that, we're thriving. We have our break. It's not called respite anymore, but we certainly do get that as an offshoot of that. When it comes to therapy, that two-year squashed-in opportunity is now for the rest of Taylor's life up till she's 65, and she gets occupational therapy, speech therapy, but also physiotherapy. And it's looked at what Taylor needs to help her reach her body's full potential.
The shift being that it's needs-based funding rather than a diagnosis-basis funding.
Yeah.
But that comes down to also very practical situations, like you were finding nappies, because she has a incontinence issue, that you were finding nappies were just a big toll on your family budget.
Yeah, well, she needs nappies 24 hours a day. She's fully incontinent. And prior to NDIA, families, after they're 5 years old, if they're still incontinent, would get a one-off $500, which really doesn't stretch very far. So now they've given us a much more realistic continence funding, and looking at funding to help us with even having nappy protectors, you know, looking at other equipment to help us with her continence. And I suppose in another huge major thing we've got with Taylor's plan is that we now have home modifications. So we've got toilet modifications to help us to get her to the goal of not being permanently incontinent, which is a huge drain not only on us but in the future for the country. We're looking at a goal of getting her to hopefully be as independent with that as possible. So that's been fantastic, in amongst other home modifications to help us and help Taylor. Yeah.
Which has enabled you to take some more work. But before I come to Ali, what hasn't worked? Because this is the crucial aspect of your participation in this trial. For example, has it been very difficult to find the service providers to match with your needs as you develop this care plan?
Yeah, that would probably, in terms of Taylor's plan, it's been very good because we've looked at all aspects, you know, the therapy, the carers, the equipment. It's a one-stop shop, which is fantastic, rather than jumping from different places trying to apply for things. Enormous thing for us. However, it is a launch site. It is new, and it's new for the community. So the service providers had to themselves understand the process as well. And Taylor's carers, it's fantastic, but it would be wonderful if there was more flexibility so that different respite places have different capabilities. So we've had to sort of jump between a few. So I would say the biggest thing for us has been having the service providers keep up with the NDIA.
Mm. Ali Stewart, mother of Rick and Meg, your children are much older. They're in their mid to late 20s, I gather. So what are their situations? What are your hopes under the National Disability Insurance Scheme?
Okay, well, with my son, he's 26 with autism and quite a severe intellectual disability. When it was Department of Human Services, he was lucky enough to have an individual support package, and that package got transferred over to NDIA. But what was lacking in that package was that there was no provision for his future. If you can imagine having, you know, a four-year-old that you can't leave, you have to be with him 24/7. Well, my son's 26 and nothing's changed. He needs someone with him 24/7.
And that was a major source of anxiety for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think by the time Ricky hits 30, I'd like to think that he could spend more time with his peer groups, living in a group home. He could still certainly come home and enjoy, you know, his family lifestyle. But I think I'd like to see him with his peers and not just with his mum and dad.
So he's at home at the moment.
He is.
So the part of your care plan is working out how he can live independently in a group home. So how is the scheme enabling that to happen?
Okay. Well, in his plan, it's all about supporting his communication and his independence. And so with his day programs that he currently attends, instead of just going to one day program, he actually has a choice. So he accesses probably three programs or four programs so that his day is filled with things that are helping him reach his goals, which is communication and independence. With the NDIA, they've provided a path for him, they've provided funding that is there for when he is ready and a home becomes available for him. It might be 5 years away, but the work's been done, the groundwork's been done to ensure that he's the best he can be and that the finances are in order to enable him to move on from his family.
So just in terms of the process that's enabled that, what are the practicalities of that? Who do you sit down with, you and Rick, and then how do you map it out?
Okay, he has quite a solid plan that covers all aspects of his life. He's non-verbal. We sat down with a planner at the NDIA and went through his plan and really every aspect of his life, what he was currently doing, what his goals were, what his needs were. And, I think the process probably took 2 months, so it's not something that happens, you know, overnight. To make sure his goals were achievable and to also make sure they were measurable. I think it's all very well to have goals, but if they're not really achievable, you know, what's the point? So putting in goals that are achievable and measurable along the way so that the NDIA could provide stepping stones to ensure he reaches his full potential and his goals.
So some people have spoken about the difficulty of the transition from the old system to the new. As a mother at the coalface, you observed? Where are the teething problems?
I'd say it was, as I said, my son was already on an individual support package, and it was a three-year plan that had only been 1 year in. It was transferred directly over, so that was smooth. But what wasn't in the system with DHS was future planning. So I've certainly found the transition excellent. If I try to think of problems, because people do like to hear about problems, there were some issues, because they are so focused, NDIA are so focused on making your young person independent from you. My son lives in Anglesey, and his dad drives him to and from a day program in Geelong, so it's, quite a hike every day, and there's quite an expense to that. NDA were prepared to put in a carer to do that, to make him independent. And we thought, no, we don't want a carer doing that because it's too expensive. You're much better off just to
use the money in other ways.
Use the money in other ways, but provide perhaps for the mileage that the family take. And that was a bit of a stepping stone to get over. And working with the NDI, they changed the rules. So they're there to listen. And if you have got suggestions, you have got, barriers, they really do work well with you.
And what about your daughter Meg?
Meg's on the other end of the autism spectrum disorder. She has Asperger syndrome with a mild intellectual disability. And her goal is really to be independent and to get a job. And Meg has the ability to do that if she gets support now. She's 27, and I'd say since she left school, all she's been doing, which is great, is more training. She's done so many courses, art courses, beauty courses, retail courses, and the list goes on. But ultimately, she wants to get a job, so it's all very well doing all these courses, but she really needed a plan put in place that would lead to a job or voluntary work. She really wants to contribute to the community, and at the moment she's raising a guide dog puppy for Guide Dogs Victoria, which is terrific, and she has done some voluntary work in aged care, but she's got a plan in place now that will enable her to live fully independently, whereas without that plan and without those skills, she's going to be a burden on society forever.
I would just come back to Rebecca Casson. Have you felt that there are clear teething problems with the process?
Well, only those that, as Ellie has outlined, and I understand from the participants and the discussions that our team have been having with them, that whilst ever this is a new process, that obviously there are lots of different aspects to understand and to clarify, and the example that Ellie provides is a perfect one, because whilst ever it wasn't necessarily a problem per se, it was more of something to overcome and to fully explain to the planners. So we believe that from the participants that have said that they are much, they all feel that it's a much better system than was previously in place. So whilst ever there might be hurdles to jump over, that the system is heading in the right direction.
One of the questions that might get raised is, well, pilots are always, there's an awful lot of investment goes into a pilot. It's kind of the perfect model, the pristine example of what is to come. But then, in fact, what is to come becomes a sort of a diminished version of that. I mean, I wonder if the way it's working in Geelong at present will look like as it does when it's fully rolled out.
Well, we believe it's important to set the standard very high, and we've been working very closely with the Victorian Minister for Disability Services and Reform, Mary Waldridge, who has taken a personal interest in this project, which is providing an excellent example of that approach, and one that you describe, in the sense that we need to make sure through this trial that we are working with people with a disability, their families and their carers, to develop the standard for the future. And we've learned so much from it so far. And indeed, we recently made the comment that we thought that it was important to establish Geelong as a centre of excellence for disability rehabilitation and insurance, with the advent of the NDIA headquarters being relocated to Geelong. But we do understand that it's important to maintain that standard and have that standard of rollout across the country.
Yes, well, that would be great, given the news about Alcoa this past week. Rebecca, for you, Vanessa, beg your pardon, for you, this has meant you've been able, this is a whole of family experience. So you've been able to go back to work more fully, I think.
Yes, I have. As I mentioned earlier, with having our carers in the morning, it's allowed me to be far more flexible so that I can then go off to work, because Taylor gets a big, huge, giant coach that comes, pulls up down our street to take her off to school. So we have to, I have to wait for, before we had India, I'd have to wait for the bus. But I've also got my other little daughter that needs to go off to school with our carers. The carers look after Taylor and they take her to the bus, and she's constantly signing in the morning, friends, friends, because she's dying to see her friends and signing bus, bus. And it's, it gives me a wonderful sense that I can leave the house and go to work. So, and I think that's another aspect to the NDIA that people must also think about, that it not only helps the individual, it helps the whole family. And we have a very educated husband who has gone through an enormous hurdle with chemotherapy, and now he's gone, you know, back to work, a member of society that's pouring back into the community, a wife who's, you know, the main carer for the daughter, who can also go back into the community, back into nursing, and a little sister that siblings often get forgotten, who's fully looked after and supported, because we can spend time with her, quality time that she desperately needs.
So it's a full,
because Taylor,
full story. Ali Stewart, final brief comment to you. What about you? Where how are you thinking about your future with your children, adult children?
Well, it's funny that you mention it, because after my planning with my daughter recently, that night I lay in bed and thought, my God, could I actually go for a holiday? Could I actually go away for 2 weeks? You know, my daughter's 27 and I haven't been able to leave her for longer than a night or two.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm nearly 60 and I'm thinking, wow, wouldn't it be nice to be able to go on a holiday? Wouldn't it be nice to spend time with adults my own age and have my children spending time with, you know, people, peers their own age? So it's quite a mind-blowing thing in your head, something that I've never, ever thought about before.
Unbelievable. What a way to wrap this discussion. Thank you very much, Ali.
Thank you.
And as one of the participants in the LEAD project in Geelong says, Tina, I just exist at the moment, but I'm looking forward to living again. She has cerebral palsy. Rebecca Casson, thank you so much for teasing out some of the themes happening there in Geelong with the implementation of this trial.
Thank you very much for having us, and just a reminder that disability is just one of the facets of the diversity in our wonderful Geelong region, and we look forward to seeing you down here soon.
Love the Geelong plug. Rebecca Casson, Executive Director of the Committee for Geelong. Vanessa McCallum, who has a daughter, one of the first participants in the National Disability Insurance Scheme trial, as is Ali Stewart with her two adult children. Love to hear from you. Remember, we want you to help us drive this constant review of how the insurance scheme is playing out. So stay in touch if you have any themes that you'd like us to follow up. On Life Matters on RN, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Now, kids love to count, but how do you get really strategic about introducing the maths early on?
Now, as an off-track podcast, an American PhD student translating Aboriginal knowledge of the seas into modern-day marine science.
You know, you've got these traditional owners who are out there on the reef every single day. If things are changing, if something strange is happening, they're the first ones to see it.
And at the world's largest marine laboratory, human sperm bank technology is helping to conserve coral. Off-track, online, anytime from the RN website.
Oh yes, be sure to listen to that series by Joel, Off Track, on Saturday afternoons. Look, reading to children, even babies, we're encouraged to do that because we know that literacy is the foundation of learning, and reading is a wonderful thing. What about mathematics? Being numerate, how early should you start, and do you know where to start? Here's a book chock full of practical ideas to make mathematical concepts and themes part of play, part of every conversation you have with children. It's got a rather formal sounding title, Early Mathematical Explorations, but it's wonderfully practical. Co-author Nicola Yelland joins us. She's Professor of Education at Victoria University. Welcome.
Thank you, Natasha, and it's nice to be here with you and your listeners.
Yes. Now, what compelled you to pull all these activities together?
Well, actually, it's the second edition of a book that came out in 1998 with my co-authors, Carmel Dietzman, who's also a professor of education at ACU, and an early childhood teacher called Deborah Butler. And we realized there was nothing there in 1998 for undergraduates, for teachers of early childhood, and for parents. And so we put together the book, and it's been in demand so much that there was a need for a second edition. And this time we've put a bit more of the sort of ideas behind the sort of practical applications in it, especially for the undergraduates and the teachers. But we still hope it's an accessible book for parents, because we believe, like you just said, that you read to children from birth, but you can actually do mathematical activities that lay down the foundations of numeracy from birth.
And you can do that while you're reading to them. But we'll get to that. And one of the keys here is creating a positivity around the use of numbers. Kids love to count. They yes. want to do it. But one of the problems, of course, is that parents underestimate their ability to help their children think mathematically. In what ways do they do that?
Well, I mean, actually, we open up the book with a story about when I was in a school a number of years ago when the children were doing mathematics, and I said, "Oh, I love mathematics," and a little child said to me, I don't like maths, it's boring." And I said, "Oh, no, it's really cool." And they said, "Oh, well, I don't like it, and my teacher doesn't like it either." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" And she said, "She never smiles when we do maths." And I hear stories like that, and I hear parents say, "Oh, I was never very good at maths." But the type of maths that we're talking about, the beginning processes and the big ideas of maths, are an integral part of our everyday lives. That's what it means to be numerate. So what we're saying is these things are essential, and they're a basic part of our life, and they can be fun. You know, you can count when you're going up steps. You tell the story about Goldilocks and the three bears, and you're looking at number, and you're looking at it relative to size. All these ideas are the big ideas of mathematics that help children and their parents and their teachers to become numerate in the 21st century.
Well, being numerate in the 21st century, we live in an era in some ways defined by data, flooded by data. So what do you think this means for children growing up in a world like this?
Well, it's interesting because there's a quote in the book from a researcher called Steen, and he says, you know, an enumerate citizen of today is as vulnerable as the illiterate peasant in Gutenberg's time. You know, there he also says that we live in a data-drenched society. But the interesting thing about today, you know, in the 21st century, mathematics should be very different than it was in the last century, because in the previous times, we very much focused on the concepts of, as abstract idea, and routines and processes to master them.
Yes, endless worksheets dedicated to exactly. adding up, subtracting. You think, well, we've got calculators now, although people lament that those skills aren't happening in people's heads, that they're going straight to the calculating device on their phone or whatever.
But it's interesting, you know, because, you know, how, I always say, how many times do you have to add up 28 and 67 and 32 and 79 to prove you can do it? You know, the whole point is that you still have to understand the concept of addition, the big idea of putting things together to make more, you know, and the basic idea of subtraction, multiplication. Those are what we call the concepts in math. But, you know, you now don't need to do the routines. You have calculators. Now, some people have said to me, you know, what would happen if all the calculators in the world disappear? And I say, are you serious? you know, what if all the electricity goes off? I say, well, there's batteries. You know, I just don't believe in that sort of way of viewing life. In fact, you have to become fluent in the use of calculators, just like you have to become fluent in driving your car and knowing all the facilities that are available to you.
Yes, indeed. Now, it starts with all those daily routines that really begin right from the cot, don't they?
Yeah.
The meal times, the bath times.
Yeah. Well, you know, just basic things like the basic relational and positional terms in mathematics, like above and below, in and out, under and over. We've got a list of them in the book, so you can encourage that language. You might think it's literacy, but it's also numeracy. You have to know, for example, right and left, because when you do formal calculations, you have to know that, you know, the units have to be lined up and the tens have to be lined up. They have to be above and below. The operation sign goes on the left. You have to know all these formalities to survive the school system. So if you don't have that basic mathematical language, you're not going to do very well later on. And even in the bath, you're talking about things floating on top of the water, things under the water, you have water play in the pool. These basic relational and positional terms are fundamental. And then we have the big ideas, the concepts of number, data, space, and measurement. And we also have the thinking skills. You know, mathematics has a lot to offer in terms of the basic processes of sorting, matching, classifying that help you to order the world and have, you know, understanding about it and talk to others about it.
And kids love to do that. It started with a button box, I think.
Yeah.
That kind of repetitive ordering and numbering and sorting and, yeah. You know,
patterns. I mean, every child loves to make patterns and thread beads and, you know, create their own patterns and talk about the patterns.
Now, but also this idea of reading to children is something so embedded, even though it's hard to get traction on that in some households. But this is important too, isn't it? This is a good way of introducing children to mathematical language, even if it's not part of the story explicitly. So, and you give lots of examples of really popular kids' books that are embedded. If only you just push the story a little bit further with your child, they're embedded with mathematical ideas.
One of my favourite books is Each Peach Pear Plum, I Spy Tom Thumb in the Cupboard, I Spy Mother Hubbard. And it's sort of a lovely rhyming a book, and the illustrations are incredible because you have Tom Thumb is up in a tree. It's an apple tree. You can count the apples. You can see the things below him, on the right of him. There are just so many amazing opportunities just in pictures and in children's own paintings to have conversations about that are, you know, that go to the basic core of literacy and numeracy. And additionally, these days with something, you know, with tablets, you have electronic books, and there's one in particular we talk about in the book about Teddy's Day, about a little girl who goes off to kindergarten and she wonders what her teddy bear is doing at home. And you read the story, and then you can open and shut the curtains. You can create an electronic picture, and then it becomes a picture on the little girl's wall in her bedroom. You can open and shut, you know, drawers and doors, and all these are wonderful opportunities for parents and caregivers to interact with children, to lay those basic foundations that will, you know, come to fruition, so to speak, to use a metaphor for later on.
Nicola Yelland is my guest this morning. She's Professor of Education at Victoria University. She's co-author of a book, Early Mathematical Explorations, and I'm glad you mentioned tablets, because obviously there's anxiety about too much screen time being bad for young children, but we have seen a proliferation of apps and games on iPads and tablets and laptops dedicated to, you know, various numerical skills. Do you think there's a stage and an age where that's appropriate?
Well, it's interesting because we're embarking in the third year of a tablet project that's been funded by IBM. And in the first year, we worked with mothers' groups with two-year-olds and some three-year-olds and kindergartens, four-year kinder in Victoria, and the first year of school in Victoria, which is the prep class. And there's a lot of literature out there that says that, you know, children should have no screen time before two. I think that's just way too harsh. I think, you know, I have a granddaughter who's 7 months old, and this morning, yesterday morning I was watching Pingu with her, and also Sesame Street. And, you know, you watch it for literally 3 to 5 minutes. And with the mother's group, with the two-year-olds, there are activities there with Lego and with, for example, Elmo, that they have watched on TV, and they might have an Elmo a doll as well, or a Dora is another one, Dora the Explorer. So from a very early age, children are having multimodal experiences. They have things in the real world, like an Elmo or a Dora doll, things in a book, which are in two dimensions, and then things that come to life on a screen. So for me, it's just a very individual decision.
Yes, you know, there's a whole spectrum of possibilities, and the tablet might just be part of it.
Yeah.
But I want to squeeze in chance and data, but particularly chance, because, you know, even someone like myself who's done enormous amount of maths at university, I stats seems to be the only real maths that I absolutely need day to day, and I never did it. And chance is something that you think can be talked about very early on, probability, possibilities, and it's the language we use.
Yes, and we mean just, you know, for example, about the weather. I know everyone talks about the weather. I mean, what are the chances of it raining today? And, you know, we always talk about, we recently talked about the drought. But, you know, chance and data, especially to me, you know, if you look at the first year of compulsory curriculum, you know, in the area of the big idea of number, we want children to be able to know numbers 1 to 10 and then 11 to 20 in the first year of school. We did some lovely work with the iPad, with the prep class, who are very fluent with number, creating graphs about number and creating number stories. So the whole point about knowing number is to apply and use number. So I just think data and chance are the most exciting topics in mathematics because children love to go around asking other people, are you right-handed or left-handed? And they take photos of their group, and then they create two axes. We talk about left and right. We talk about horizontal and vertical. We use all that, you know, the sort of official language of mathematics from 5 years old, because, you know, it becomes embedded in their vocabulary. And then they generate sentences about those. You know, isn't it interesting that we've only got four people that are left-handed in our group, and we've got 20, you know, who are right-handed? Why is that? And then they go off on another investigation. And these are sort of the classic examples of becoming numerate, the using the mathematics skills and concepts in everyday life.
And then the question becomes, but I need to get you back to talk about this another time, is how you translate that well into high school and beyond. This conversation about that kind of early literacy is really powerful, but then how does that translate into performance in maths later on? But we've got to go. Fantastic to have you on the show. Hope we can get you back, Nicola.
Oh, that would be great. I listened to your wonderful program last year with those two very passionate, exciting teachers, you know, maths and science in the secondary school, two wonderful young women, and I was just inspired by them.
Yes, they were great, and I might put a link to that on our Facebook page in case people missed it. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Natasha, for having me.
Professor Nicola Yelland from Victoria University, and the book we were discussing is Early Mathematical Explorations. I'll pop a post up on our Facebook page just to get some ideas from you about how you're building a passion for numbers for your children, or some of the difficulties that you've had doing that. Well, up next, an extraordinarily incredible life. Actually, I don't even know how to describe it. There aren't the words.
This afternoon on the Health Report, find out about P4 medicine from one of the founders of the Human Genome Project.
We've developed a series of organ-specific blood protein fingerprints that will allow us to follow disease transitions from wellness to disease in the brain, in the heart, and in the liver.
That's predictive, preventive, personalised and participatory healthcare, next on the Health Report this afternoon at 5:30 here on RN.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. In the words of Shakespeare and gracing the Life Matters stage right now is a man who's lived a wild and theatrical life, both on and off stage, it seems, playing countless roles, although his name might not be overly familiar to you. It's Trader Faulkner, Ronnie Faulkner, Australian. He spent 50 years on the stage, mentored by, early on, in fact, right here at the ABC, I think, by the British-born Australian actor Peter Finch, friends with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. And Trader also went on to become an unlikely aficionado of flamenco dance too. Such was his love of Spain. Welcome.
Thank you, and lovely to be here, Natasha.
Likewise, and wonderful memoir, Inside Trader. Now, have we got your headphones set up properly? Is that comfortable?
I don't know.
Yes. And you've got control over the volume there, just letting you know. So you came into the world as Ronnie.
Ronnie Faulkner.
1927,
born in Mossman, grew up at Queenscliff, joined the Queenscliff Surf Club in 1943, always terrified of the surf and was very, very nearly taken by a shark.
Early on. We might never have had you.
No.
Why'd you throw out the name Ronnie? Where'd Trader come from? Because this is quite a story in its own right.
Well, when I started school at the Manly Public School in Darley Road in, I think it was March 1934, the marble craze was on. So Dad bought me 100 marbles and I'd had measles. So one of my eyes was a bit gammy and I lost all my ghoulies. And they said, oh, well, Ronnie, you better go home and get some more ghoulies. So my dad was a silent movie actor in Sydney, and he was a very good dad. And he, I said, oh, Dad, I've lost all my ghoulies. He said, well, I bought you 100. I'm not buying you any more. So I said, what'll I do? I said, I can't go back to school with no ghoulies. So now, Dad, this was a very bad time because the film industry had crashed with the Wall Street in 1929. Dad was on the skids, but he used to distill illicit whiskey in the bath. he worked for Bass's Ales, and he learned to distill.
I didn't read that in the book.
Well, there's a lot of things that had to be cut out, and maybe that was one of the things. But at any rate, he used to distill this whiskey in the bath, and on Thursdays, the bathroom was always locked. And if I wanted to spend a penny, I had to go downstairs to Mrs. Fluke. And there's no way I could get in the bathroom because Dad was what they called a Grand Master of Freemasonry. And he used to go and flog all this bombo to his Freemason mates. But there was a ladder left outside the back of the flats. And I thought, if I can get up that ladder, fill some Marchant's ginger beer bottles with what he was called Jack the Rattler, with Rattler's whiskey, take it to school and trade it for the marbles that I lost, I'd be okay. So I got into the bathroom, got up the ladder, filled up, I think, 5 bottles of this Dad's Bombo, took it to school, and the next day they said, well, you got your ghoulies, Ronnie? I said, no, I've got 5 bottles of Dad's best whiskey. So I said, a couple of swigs of that and your nuts will drop. So,
and so the name Trader stuck.
I traded. We all got drunk. I was expelled and Dad took me home, walloped me with his razor strap and said, I seem to have spawned a right little trader.
That's great.
That's it.
And it stuck. It sure did. And you mentioned your father, John. He was a silent film star. Your mother, Sheila, a ballerina.
She was
danced
a ballerina.
Anna Pavlova and...
Diaghilev. She started with Diaghilev and then with Pavlova and then went to America and to New York and danced as what they call principal coryphée in the opera seasons with Caruso, Shelley, Arpingeli, all those sort of very, very interesting life, Mum.
She regaled you with these stories throughout your childhood.
Absolutely.
But this must have felt like miles away growing up as a kid by the beach in Manly.
In Manly, it seemed a long way. But of course, she used to have these ballet classes on Saturday mornings. And I used to go and sit there and I was terribly bored, you know, sitting there. And I remember one day when they were all trooping in and out and I was a very, very naughty boy. And I said, if you show me what you've got, I'll show you what I've got. And the mothers went to my mother and said, Mrs. Faulkner, we love the classes, but little Trader, he's so naughty. So my mother didn't know what to do, so she sent me to a boarding school.
Which... At 7, your dad died. He was much older than your mum.
And they were 10 years between them. He was born in 1872. Mum was born 1892. Yes, there was and of course it was absolute calamity when my mother became pregnant. They never expected to have a child.
Well, they didn't really want you, did you?
Did they really
describe you as an infuriating liability early on in your life?
I was. Well, I was because Dad died in 34, then my grandfather died in 35. I saw them both die, and my grandmother had bipolar. She went nuts, and I had to witness that. We had to go out and find her body, and I became rebellious. You know, both the men had died, and I was brought up by my mother, and I resented it. I wanted a man. And
that grief, you can feel that grief threaded through this memoir in some sense.
And the thing is, you've got to laugh. Life is a circus and we're all clowns. And the thing is, you've got to laugh. And the worse the tragedy, unfortunately, you've got to laugh. You know, I'm always just thankful that I'm not bedridden. When I think of the number of people that are born, they'll never even walk.
I need to explain to listeners that you've decked out in beautiful red vest and a beautiful red beret. it was an amazing entrance to the studio this morning.
Well, I like red. You know, I like colour. You know, in London, where I live, everybody dresses in grey and brown, and I think, come on, dress against the climate.
Now, you started at the ABC Record Library, but really much not long after that, as a young man out of school. Peter Finch, the British-born Australian actor, really seemed to take you under his wing.
Well, in Market Street, there was a coffee bar called Reppin's, and my mother went in there to meet Tamara Chinarova, the ballerina who's Finch's wife, and Finch was there. And I was at a loss at what to do, and I knew Peter Finch. We'd heard him on the radio. And he said, your father was an actor, why don't you, I've got an acting school, will you come and work with me? So I went and worked with Finchie, and he sent me to an acrobat, he sent me to a circus.
To disinhibit yourself.
What?
To let go of your inhibitions, that was his key.
He said when the Poms act, they're not physically free. Will you be my guinea pig? So I said, yeah, too right. So I went out to Ultimo, to a gymnast. He was an old acrobat called Ted Ardini, and Ted Ardini taught me how to do the backflip, which is a terrifying move because you've got to fly backwards onto your hands, then fly back off your hands onto your feet. And, of course, first of all, he did it in a harness. That was fine. And then Finchie came along to see my progress. He said, OK, take off the harness. Took off the harness, and suddenly, without that belt, without that support, I was terrified. Anyway, I finally did it. They flicked me on the back of the legs with a little sort of piece of cane and took me over. And, of course, it gave me enormous confidence.
Yeah, it's one way to start a career in radio plays, which is what you did. You performed in ABC radio plays. You then went to London and did some work with the BBC, which became a 50-year relationship with the BBC in radio
plays.
That's
right.
But how was it so early on that you came to be taking over a role from Richard Burton on Broadway?
Well, Tyrone Guthrie was out here. He was a great director. And I was in The Merry Wives of Windsor at the Independent Theatre in North Sydney and playing Dr. Caius, a French physician, and Guthrie liked it. He thought I was the best thing in it, and he said, if you come to London, I'll cast you in the play that I've written called Top of the Ladder, if you come next year. So I came, and, of course, when I arrived, the play was postponed, and Guthrie then wrote to H.M. Tennant, which were the top London management. I auditioned. And this tall, bald man with a very long nose came down the front of the stall. He said, I'm Jordan Kielgud. What's your name? I said, Ronnie Faulkner, sir. It was sir back in 1950. He said, oh, my God, what a dreary name. I said, well, in Australia, down under, I said, I'm known as a trader. He said, trader? Trader Faulkner? Oh, he said, that's a wonderful name. We'll bill you on Broadway as trader. Welcome to the company. And I was in, took over from Richard Burton on Broadway. Richard went to Stratford to play Henry V. I went to Broadway to play in The Ladies Not for Burning.
And I love Richard Burton's telegram to you on the night was, best of luck tonight from Richard, the son of nobody.
Son of nobody. And that's the character in the play, Richard, son of nobody. And it was from Richard, I think he said, Richard, former son of nobody. I was now the son of nobody. He was a lovely guy, Richard.
John Gielgud actually also made you get rid of your Australian accent and got you, what did he say? I think, oh, for God's sake, take that compost out of your vowel sounds.
Take that compost out of your vowels. It's Brown's cows go round and round. I said, yeah, Brown's cows go round the townhouse. You know, and it went on and on. And eventually I got rid of it.
Amazing. Did you stay in touch with Richard Burton?
Yes, he used to come. I lived on a houseboat down at Chelsea, and Burton used to come down there. He'd bring some bottles of gin or whiskey or whatever, and we'd sit out on the quarterdeck and drink. He was a great drinker, Richard, and of course that killed him. But yes, he was a good mate, but you never got very close to Burton. You know, he was a person very contained within himself, but. Not like Finchie. That was a different story. I'll tell you, one day I was living on the houseboat and Finchie rang up and he said, I'm over the river at the pub. He said, would you like to come over and have a couple of schooners? So I raced over Battersea Bridge, around to Battersea, and there was Finchie. And I was so excited to meet him. I said, Finchie, look, I got to go and spend a penny. Where is it? And he had a rather wicked look. And he said, you go down that corridor, turn left, and put your weight against that door. At the end, you'll be in there. I put my weight against the door. I was in the river. Oh. It was high tide, but Finchie, of course, knew that I could swim. And, of course, I floated back to the houseboat where I lived. And, of course, my mother was hanging out the washing, and she said, "Trader, what on earth are you doing there?" Oh, I said, "I've just been to see Finchie. Just meant to have a meeting with Finchie, but it didn't actually happen."
And that boat was a part of your life for many years. So how did you come to be so close to Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh?
Well, I'd walked on in Sydney in 1948 when they were here, and then one day my agent called me and he said, "You've got a non-speaking part in the film of Richard III, Olivia's film." So I went, and I was cast as the Duke of Northumberland. I think it was non-speaking part, and I couldn't understand why I was in a film in a non-speaking part that wasn't in the script. Eventually, of course, this character I'd seen as Richard III came across. He said, "Where have I seen you before?" And I said, "Oh, Sir Laurence." I said, "In Sydney." I walked on. He said, "Of course I remember. Now come over with me." I walked across the, and there was a woman sitting there. And he said, "Puss," that's his, was his name. He said, "Puss, meet Sebastian in Twelfth Night next year." And this woman took off a dark glass. It was Vivien. I was looking at Scarlett O'Hara. And she said, "You're Trader Faulkner." She said, "I adore Peter Finch, and Peter trained you, and he's told me all about you, and we're going to play twins next year."
And you did.
And, of course, on the opening night, John Gielgud, he ruined the production. He upset everybody. And on the first night, Vivien called me up to her dressing room, and she said, "Trader," she said, "this production is going to be a disaster." She said, "How much are you paid a week?" I said, £25 a week. She said, "You know when Sebastian and Viola as twins meet at the end, we have that kiss." She said, "Do you think we could hold on the kiss?" Mm-hmm. Oh, I said, "Viv," I said, "I'd need £27 a week to hold on a kiss with you, darling." She said, "What if I paid you 30? I said, "Well, I'll think about it."
Did you get your 30?
Yeah, I got the 30.
You got 30. Your 30?
I got the 30, and every time we did the kiss, Vivien Leigh and I did the kiss on stage, the audience went,
"It worked. It was worth every quid."
Oh, boy, was it. She was a one. She was a great mate. And not long, I was married to a girl who had modelled out here called Bobo Faulkner. Mm. And not long before Viv died, it was only about a month, a couple of weeks before she died, Bobo said, "I would have loved to have met Vivien Leigh." I said, "Well, I'll ask her to come and have dinner." And I rang her up and I said, "Viv, would you come to dinner and meet my new wife?" I hadn't spoken to her for a long time. She said, "Yes." She said, "Can I bring my boyfriend, John Merivale,
who looked after?" Enduring
And she arrived with her cat, and we had the most wonderful evening. And at the end, she took me by both wrists and she said, "Trader, treasure her. She's very, very beautiful." Now, this was a remark from one of the most beautiful women. And I would rate Vivien, and Bobo never forgot that. And I would rate Vivien. Vivien was one of a handful of the greatest actresses of the 20th century, without any question.
And incredible to have her in your life. We've only got a couple of minutes left, literally. And I just, how did you become a Hispanophile and an absolute gun at flamenco dance?
Well, there was a wonderful actor came to London called Antonio. And I never wanted to do ballet. I found that ballet for me was effeminate. I mean, I admire it as an art form, but I didn't want to do it. And I saw this guy, Antonio, dance, and I thought, that's what I want to do. Mm. I want to use my body as well as with my voice. Mm. I could do acrobatics, and I thought, that's a way to dance. And eventually a wonderful dancer called Antonio Gardes, he came over. He made a couple of films. He made a film of Blood Wedding, Carmen, and L'Amo Brujo. There were three films. If ever you see them, they're worth seeing, Gardes. And Gardes said, "Do you want to be a flamenco dancer?" I said, "No, I want to be an actor who can dance flamenco." He said, "Then I'll teach you." And he taught me that, because the feet and all that, anybody can do that. It's the part above the body. Mm. That's the individuality. That's the style.
Mm. That incredible posture too.
Oh, posture, yeah. Mm. And I worked. I used to go and stamp away in the very near where I lived was a place that had a cellar. It was a club. And I used to go down there. I'd do a show I was doing, whatever it was in London during the day, have my dinner, then I'd go down in the cellar and just stamp away till about 3 or 4 in the morning, and that's how I learned to dance.
We've barely got a glimpse, but life is in London.
Life is...
Not back in Australia.
I would love to come back for the climate, and I'd love to come back for my mates, for my friends, but no, London is the challenge. you know, and it's also the climate is the bloody challenge, I can tell also, you. It's so cold there.
Yeah, you better stay here for a while. The weather's pretty. Although I see spring's coming in London now.
Be pardon?
I see spring is sprouting in London.
At last, yeah. But it's been beautiful here and lovely to go back to Queenscliff and you know, go down to the beach and meet the boys and go back. But, of course, all my most of the people of my time are not there anymore. They're gone. They're dead.
Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a thrill to have been here, I can tell you.
We've barely scratched the surface of this incredible life. Trader Faulkner, Inside Trader is the name of his memoir. It's published by Scribe. And, wow, it is chock full of names and some classic photos. Michael Cathcart's coming up next with White Knight Melbourne.
Yes, indeed. White Knight took over Melbourne over the weekend. And we'll look at this debate about Transfield and its sponsorship of the Sydney Biennale.
Oh, yes. That's very interesting. Coming up to 10 a.m. Thanks for your company today. Join us tomorrow.
Kia ora, Siri. Aroha mai te poka nei. Mihi mai kia whaia Annabelle.
This week, Rear Vision visits an Indigenous high school in New Zealand where they teach not in English but in Māori language and where their kids are achieving academically as well, if not better, than their non-Indigenous counterparts. So what can we learn? You can download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.